Hello and welcome everyone to Scotland's Rural College podcast discussion series here at the 2019 Royal Highland Show, taking a fresh look at some of the issues facing modern Scottish agriculture and offering the chance for you, the public, to put questions to our expert panellists. I'm Sian Hickson and our episode today is called Climatarian. Climate change is the challenge of our lifetime. With debates around the best way to feed a growing global population making headlines, when it comes to the question of the optimum diet for the planet, it can be difficult to separate the facts from the flannel. Our speakers today, Laura Young, David Nazeri, and Pete Ritchie, will be helping us to find our way through the topic. Laura Young, also known as Less Waste Laura, is an environmental influencer and current SRUC master's student, with 23,000 followers on Instagram alone. Her public advocacy for living a less impactful lifestyle has given her the opportunity to learn and speak about the ways we can make a big difference in the way we live, and she recently delivered a talk on kicking the plastic habit to 2,000 people at the TEDx Glasgow event. David Nazeri is originally from Sacramento, California, and he's a lecturer in the environment at SRUC, following on from an MSc in soils and sustainability. Pete Ritchie is a first-generation organic farmer and also director of Nourish Scotland, an NGO campaigning on food justice issues. Okay, so first of all, how do we define climatarianism?
I can jump in on this.
Please
so
do.
It's about making decisions with what you eat, and you're basing that on the environment and particularly how to make the lowest impact. And it's very unique to where you are in the world. Yeah, that's kind of how I would do a rounded summary.
David, what do you think?
I fully agree with Laura, and the fact that to tell you the truth, I had never heard of the word until this panel came up. I dug around, did some research, and I think it's similar to if you imagine a vegetarian or kind of diet, people who are concerned and would like to mitigate climate change, so they'll choose a diet that reflects that. And so we're talking about things that, you know, lessen dependence on resources and uses resources more efficiency and your carbon footprint.
And what do you think about the current map of Scottish food production distribution in terms of climatarianism? Pete, I'm going to come to you as co-owner of Whitmore Organics, which is a organic farm in the Borders.
Yeah.
How does climatarianism figure in what you're planning to do with your business?
Well, in terms of business, we grow some food, and we grow a lot of cows and sheep, not a lot of cows and sheep, but they eat the grass, and that makes sort of sense. We also have some pigs, which are more efficient at producing meat, but they eat grain and they eat soya. So it's very much a question about which of those is most efficient. We're getting rid of the pigs, not so much because we don't like them, but because they actually reduce our ability to lock up carbon on the farm, because we have to plough after the pigs, because when they're in a field as part of the rotation, we then have to plough, and it reduces our soil carbon. It's really important to remember that half of the excess carbon in the atmosphere is not from oil, but from soil. So it's the way that we've been doing farming for the last couple hundred years has made a huge impact on the amount of carbon dioxide in the air, because when you plough, the bugs get active and they release CO2 into the atmosphere. So the biggest thing we can do as farmers is to get carbon back in the soil. And whether we do that through planting trees, or whether we do that through the way we manage the grassland, or the way we manage cover crops, that's our single most important thing that we can contribute.
So the idea of a farm as a carbon sink is very interesting. Would you like to expand a bit more on how larger farms are or are not kind of connecting with that practice?
Okay, there's challenges. Scotland has about a third of the UK's soil carbon, and particularly in our peatlands, but even in our agricultural lands, we tend to have higher carbon soils, and that's partly because it's cold and wet here, so carbon doesn't cycle as quickly as it does when you get warmer and drier. So we've got a great advantage in being able to lock up carbon. There's still areas of the east coast of Scotland where historically we've had a lot of arable crops where carbon low soil levels are much lower than they could be. But the main thing that we're not doing in Scotland is integrating trees and crops and integrating trees and livestock. There's absolutely no reason why every ruminant animal in Scotland couldn't have access to a hedge or a tree to browse. It's good for their health, it's good for shade, it's good for shelter, it provides extra biomass. If you have trees on your farm, you can produce the same amount of stock, but actually lock up much more carbon at the same time. So this is a complete no-brainer. Our difficulty is that historically farming and forestry in Scotland and the UK have been seen as entirely separate professions, which is not the case in most of the world and most of Europe, which is why we have our ideal of a farm in Scotland is a big flat green field with a few sheep in it without any trees. And for us, that looks like a natural, tidy landscape, but it's actually not good for the sheep and it's certainly not good for the planet.
So would you be an advocate of not ploughing, of the no-plough movement?
Yeah, as far as possible, you always want to keep the ground covered. If the ground's not got green stuff on it, then it's not photosynthesizing. If it's not photosynthesizing, it's not locking up carbon. So every minute that our fields are brown, I'm feeling really bad about that because we're not doing anything to take the sun's energy and turn it into carbon or turn it into food for that matter.
Thank you. So that's looking a little bit at the food production map, but if we're looking instead at the distribution map and how food gets from the production areas to the table, Laura, I know that's something that you focused on.
So I think food miles are really important, but it's also important to know that different areas in Scotland can produce different foods, and it's not always it's not always an option to produce the same foods everywhere. So I think a lot of the things I try and do is talk about reducing your food miles and saying, well, what's local to me? What can I get local? But it is important to know that if you are in the West Coast versus the East Coast, there are things that will just have to travel further to get to you because of the way our country is designed.
And how do people get to know that?
So getting to know that is, I mean, you could have a Google and, you know, talk about what can we grow in the UK, what can we grow in Scotland, and then thinking, do you have local farms? So I got a veg box when I moved to Edinburgh, and it's from a local farm on the East Coast, and every time I get it, it's got something new and something that's seasonal, something I've probably never heard of, and that's a really good way. I've been educating myself primarily on what can be grown here, and I think there's lots of ways by just asking or even just seeing in the supermarkets when you're looking at the little sticker, just looking at what country does it say, and if it says the UK, then it's really interesting to know. Yes, sorry.
Can I jump in too? And also just to piggyback off some of Laura's comments, I think technology can play a big role here. So I know that there's several apps that the average consumer can use. Like there's an app called Too Good To Go, which connects people with unsold food from restaurants, which they can purchase at a reduced price. Although there's probably logistical problems in rural areas, but encourage people to do their own research and try. When I'm talking about various apps that you could possibly try, and there's a simple Google search will find other things like Olio helps connect households and businesses with food. And just by taking a photo, you can give a description and pick up details, and it's free and it connects people to other people, which I think we have to kind of redefine our value system and see food not just as a, it's almost like, you know, sometimes you're just something to get you through the next 4 hours. It should be culturally, you know, very valuable and connect people and be an empowering thing. Drifted a little bit away from the individual consumers have to play in the role of the food production system, but yeah. And also, sorry, one more. There's one called Good To Go that gives free takeaway boxes to businesses, because research shows that customers are often too shy to ask for doggy bags, but and they put stickers that will say how fresh it is, when it will go bad, so that can alleviate some of those concerns. And Zero Waste Scotland does a Love Food, Hate Waste app, which is also offers some nice ways to cut down on waste. So I think technology can help too.
So we're talking a little bit here about the role that we as individual consumers have to play in reducing waste across the food production chain. But then there's the bigger question of if a third of all food that is produced gets wasted, who is it that's primarily responsible for that wastage?
Okay, well, it's primarily us, primarily individuals. The biggest chunk is household food waste. Retail sector's done very well for the most part. Some of that is by shifting waste further up the supply chain. But certainly the UK retail sector has improved its performance hugely on that, and got waste down. So in best example, is down to about 0.5%, which is pretty impressive. I wish we could do that in our farm shop. So, and that's smart logistics. It's knowing what time of day to get things in, but it depends on the just-in-time supply chain, and it also depends on being able to have more than excess supply. So always have supply in stock. And obviously that works fine for dried goods. It's tough with fresh veg, which is why you get a lot of fresh veg and fresh fruit wastage. You also get a lot of wastage up the supply chain through grade outs, and Laura can say more about that. But I just want to make a point about, you asked about distribution consumption. The really important thing that people also need to understand is that Scotland's farming system is not designed to feed people in Scotland. There is a complete disconnect between what we produce and what we eat. And that's got lots of historical reasons. We've always been an economy that's primarily served London, so the point of Scotland is to feed London. And we've not really ever had a very strong local food economy or local food markets. And if you add to that, just there tends to be a simplification of agriculture, so that farmers tend to do one thing, they do it well, they do one thing, and they sell commodities, not food. So we have very few examples of viable short food chains where farmers are supplying food to people. And milk's an example, I'm sure Laura will want to talk more about too, where we used to have that quite well sewn up till the 60s, when one of the key things the multiple retailers had to do was to pull the doorstep milk deliveries out. And by using milk as a loss leader, they managed to break that link between dairy farmers and their customers, which is why you've now got an absurdly long supply chain for something as simple as milking a cow and putting in a bottle. And that's changing, which is great to see. But it's really important to remember also that half the food we eat in Scotland doesn't come from Scotland. Well, more than half doesn't come from Scotland, half doesn't come from the UK. And a lot of what we eat now isn't really what you'd call food. You know, it's not discernibly from a farm. It's something which has been manufactured in a factory. Even the sandwiches we eat in most places we go to eat sandwiches were made in Birmingham, you know, so with ingredients from 10 or 12 or 15 countries. So the whole way that we eat is very strongly disconnected from, you know, the idea that there's food at the farm gate, there's commodities at the farm gate, and we're about four steps down the chain from that easily.
That's fascinating. So Scotland's primarily producing food for people that are not resident here. Where are our biggest exporters? Where are we going to with the food that we produce?
Well, so over 90% of our lamb's exported, primarily to France and Italy. So the thing that we use a huge chunk of our land for, we don't eat. We almost eat lamb in Scotland. As Jim Withers would say, we eat more salt than lamb in Scotland. So one of the biggest things we do with our land, which is to grow sheep, is not for us. And they go to France and Italy and Germany, particularly where they like the sort of size of carcass that we have in Scotland. In terms of beef, we export about a third of it, and then we import about a third of it, mostly from Ireland. We have six times as many potatoes that we grow than we eat. We mostly export those. Nobody eats potatoes anymore. We grow enough wheat to break every loaf in Scotland six times over with our own wheat. We don't use any of it, or we didn't until about 3 years ago when some friends got organised to have an organic wheat supply chain in Scotland. But primarily, you know, there's not anybody matching up. And there's no policy that would say it would be really good to feed more of us in Scotland from the food in Scotland, and that market simply doesn't operate in that way. So, and it's a long established tradition that we export commodities and then we buy in products. And whiskey is the one glowing counterexample where we actually add value in Scotland, and that basically keeps a lot of the Scottish economy going. But a lot of our other products, we don't add value in Scotland. We export potatoes and we buy crisps.
I think it's something very notable there that's come up a couple of times in this discussion so far, is what role laws actually play in shaping the way things are at the moment, and what can the agricultural industry in Scotland do to influence the direction taken in terms of government policy, as well as individual consumption habits. I'm thinking particularly of the fact that a tort or a condition of sale still exists in the law. If you take food that's been given away from a supermarket and you get sick and you decide to sue, that supermarket is still liable, which has led to a lot of supermarkets deciding that they're going to lock their waste bins, not give food away. And that applies not only, of course, to supermarkets, but to restaurants and cafes, because they don't want to be liable. And you were just talking there about, you know, the way that the laws that impact the how our food is produced and distributed. So what can the agricultural industry do to influence the government and the lawmakers to take a better direction for a climatarian diet.
Do you want to speak specifically around waste? Because Laura's probably the wizard on that.
I mean, in terms of waste, it's a difficult one because you do have this kind of legal thing and liability, and why would a supermarket want to risk putting money? There's a good example, though, in Edinburgh. The first waste supermarket has just opened, and so they take products from cafes and shops and things that otherwise was going to go in the bin because it was past it, even though it's not, and they're now selling that on, which is a really great example of the fact that it can happen. And I think as well, one of the major shifts is this idea of when you've got a best before date, and I think these are hard for people because I have family and friends who would never eat something past a best before date because it's on the packaging and they think it's there for a reason. I think that's one of the things we need to combat as well and say, why is that on, or what does that mean? And actually educating people around the fact that it's probably fine and is fine to eat. And that's probably something, I don't know where that would come in terms of legislation or what can be done, but I think that's one of the main things in terms of food waste.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're right. Food labelling is huge and everyone's really confused by it. Best before date, best after date, expiration date. You know, there's multiple dates going on that you can't really make sense of. And on top of that, public messages should do a lot to make people feel like it's okay and you don't have to throw those out. And on top of that, there's ways to share and to just redistribute that food in a safe manner so people aren't going to get sick. And I think we could do a lot better with those kinds of messages.
Who do you think is or should be responsible for distributing these messages? Because I'm not sure many people know what the best diet is. In terms of if you're in Scotland, and does it really vary from region to region?
Well, I think for me, it's really good to have people, you know, looking things up and making their own decisions, and you know. But to be honest, a lot of people either don't have the time or the inclination, and it's a reasonable expectation, as far as I can see, that our retailers and our multiple caterers do that work for us. You know, we have a government guide on nutrition that says this is what we should be eating. This is a planetary, sustainable, healthy diet. You know, what we buy in the supermarket should match collectively what the government thinks we should be eating. And we should develop policy which aligns what the retailers and caterers do with what the public needs to eat and what's tolerable for the planet. And there's perfect examples of that. If you take the European standards on car emissions, the big car company is about to get a stonking fine because they haven't got their average emissions from their fleet down to 90 grams per kilometre, right? So they're going to get fined by the EU. We're not using the same sort of approach either with our retailers to say, look, you need to get your average climate footprint health message in your food down to X because that's where we need to be and we're going to fine you if you don't make that. So actually using the supply chain and using legislation to drive those sorts of changes. And, of course, the supermarkets actually don't mind this. Right? That's the odd thing. Tesco's already announced they're going to try and halve the environmental footprint of the UK shopping basket. You know, they are on this, and there is a determination to move forward. They've also taken best before dates off a lot of their products. So it's not that things aren't moving, but what we need is to make sure that they keep moving quicker and to get legislation in place to drive some of these changes. Because for a lot of retailers, a level playing field is much better than voluntary action. Because if you say, wouldn't it be nice if you did this? They say, fine, but if we go first, we lose money. It's the same thing about opening the freezers in the shops, keeping a freezer open because people will go in and take something out of the freezer and you go, but that's a huge waste of energy. And they say, yeah, but if we shut our freezers, we'll sell less than the people next door. We all have to shut our freezers same day. So it's that thing about we need to use legislation to drive those sorts of policy changes.
I suppose there's a common perception that for a long time it's been the supermarket chains that call the shots over what is sold within them rather than the consumer. And I'm just thinking about, is it a sort of dual-pronged approach where we have to convince the customer on the ground in Tesco's, you know, with their basket, what is right and healthy for the environment for them to be picking? Or is it a case, as you say, of trying to enact legislation to make, well, yes, to have a level playing field, I suppose, to have all the supermarket chains and the retailers acting as one. But if you're someone that's outside of politics, how can you make a change?
Well, there's one idea that's been floating around for a while, and it's, I know that on food, specifically packaged food, there's, you know, the amber, green, red traffic lights, and that's basically saying red is very high in sugar, fat, whatever, and as a consumer, you're looking at that going, I know this is going to be good for me, bad for me, or indifferent. And there's talk about people in the kind of environmental world going, wouldn't it be great if food had some sort of way of knowing this has a really high impact on the environment? There's very logistical problems with this, because as we've been talking about, where you are in the world has an impact, and what's local to you, but it's kind of about getting consumers to easily be able to see that's a really bad product, because I spend half of my time looking up products and trying to find out, are they bad? Are they really bad? You read totally conflicting things, and it's a lot of time to work out actually what milk should I drink, and it feels like not a lot of people are going to do that. But it's as a consumer being able to kind of have a flash of colour to see that's a good thing, that's a bad thing. But I think it is really important that when customers do decide, actually, this is the change we're going to make, they do have a really big power. So a lot of the stuff that, the example I always use is milk, but it's because it's a great one, and it's because people started to demand not having it in plastic, and now there are dairies now popping up all over the place. And I know that the one that was recently in the news is Graham's Family Dairy, for their 80th anniversary, has brought back glass, and that's because other dairies were doing it and other dairies were getting loads of business. So that's obviously an example about plastic to glass, but it's an example of customers and people just going, actually, no, I'm not going to buy it in plastic anymore. I'm going to find somewhere else, or I'm going to email about it. And then that's made a big change in lots of different businesses. So I think as a consumer, we do have a lot of power. If there's a lot of us, or even if just you're one person and you're quite noisy about it, I think there is a huge impact we can have in shifting it. And if you were to take all of the dairies now in Scotland going and doing glass, there must be a dip somewhere in someone's, you know, milk consumption in a Tesco, in a Asda. So I think we can make a big impact on that.
Yeah, I think the question of who is responsible, well, we all are. You know, it's producers, it's consumers, supply chains, especially in the developed world. We have this kind of there's an interesting case study from the Netherlands in which they've worked in congruent with local schools, government officials, consumers, supermarkets. And they've been able to reduce their obesity levels. I think one of the only countries in the world in the last 10 years of, we've had all these, you know, eat more fruit and veg, but just telling people isn't really working. So, but they've kind of worked together with all these diverse people who are connected across the whole food chain, and they've managed to bring down those obesity levels in the most vulnerable populations of minorities and poor people who don't have as much or have lower socioeconomic status. And they brought them down pretty significantly, a few percent just in the last couple of years. And so if that downward trajectory continues, that's a really good model for other countries to adopt, Scotland included. But yeah, I think I totally agree with Laura that we have a lot of our own responsibility, and it can be fun to kind of unlock that puzzle and work at it, but we also need to do things like write directly to our local MP and try if we can to get involved with civic community and community organizations, because your voice is a lot stronger when it's coupled with other efforts.
So I think coming up to the final question from me is, the Committee on Climate Change wants the UK government as a whole to commit to reduce net emissions to zero by 2050. Net zero is a big challenge for the agricultural industry. Is it achievable?
All right. Well, the agricultural industry, the way it's defined at the moment, can't do net zero. What the agricultural industry can do is to reduce the emissions from producing food and counterbalance those by locking up more carbon in soils and by planting trees. We can do quite a lot to reduce emissions, certainly of nitrous oxide and certainly of CO2. Methane's tough because we don't have a magic bullet yet for reducing methane, and we've got to understand that what Scotland does is grow grass. It makes more sense to use some of that grass, not all of that grass, but to grow cattle and sheep than it does to grow grain to send to Thailand to feed chickens with soy for Latin America and then import the chicken from Thailand. That doesn't make a lot of sense, even if people think that chicken is healthier for you. So we have to devise a system that works for Scotland, that actually requires and encourages and supports our farmers to reduce the emissions of what they do. But we have to recognise too that the main thing we can do to mop up our remaining emissions is about land use, and it's about locking up carbon in the sea, where we still got a lot of scope, but also locking it up on land. And we imagine that we don't want to see a Scotland where the lowlands become ever more intensive, producing crops to feed to other animals, while all our hills are completely covered with Sitka spruce that isn't producing any biodiversity or any landscape value. So we have to have a land use plan for Scotland which says, what does land use look like in net zero, and how are we going to get it, and how are we going to support farmers to work smarter? Because the upside of this is, if farmers are wasting less resources by putting on too much fertilizer or burning too much diesel in their tractors, then actually they'll make some money if they get more climate friendly.
Laura, what do you think?
I mean, I completely agree with that. I think it's changing the way we're farming to do with all of the spare bits of land, and are we using them to suck down as much carbon as possible, or are we just not using them at all? I think that's really important. And yeah, it's just finding ways of making farming more efficient. So I'm not an expert on the farming side of it, but I know I've had friends who have studied with SRUC and know that there's research going on to do with efficient breeds of animals or efficient farming ways like ploughing or leaving land. And it's really about adopting them. And I think, you know, farming was the first job, and sometimes it's hard to move away from something that has been done in a certain way, but it's saying we can do the same things for a lot less impact. And then again, yeah, thinking what do we buy, where do we buy it from, can we be swapping our own habits and supporting our own food needs with more of what's grown here. Yeah, but I think everything that's already been said, 100%.
Yeah, I'm not going to disagree with that. We need radical change on a complete systematic level. And I think at SRUC and within the wider community, there's a lot of leadership, at least from the top, that a circular economy, meaning that all your inputs and outputs are used, that kind of simulate and are similar to a natural ecosystem. There's a term, agroecology, and kind of sustainable intensification that are being bounced around, and these are kind of facets of where we need to go, but it's just going to require a lot of coordinated energy and effort. But the positive boosts are, you know, food security, biodiversity, general health for the population. So we'll get there, I think, in the short answer, but it's going to take some work.
Thank you very much. I'd now like to open it up to questions from the audience. So if there's anything you'd like to ask the panel, please put your hand up and Ali will hand you the microphone.
Disaster. Hello. Just another tool in the box, maybe gene editing and CRISPR-Cas9 technology to make more efficient breeds, for example, to reduce that carbon output or make farming more efficient. How does the panel view that type of technology to help?
Do you want to say something about that?
Yeah, I mean, I know that typically that kind of thing, if we're talking about, it's currently, I'm not sure about the exact legislation, but are you talking about GMOs have been banned in Europe, so there's skeptical population there, but CRISPR is a different kind of technology because it's not using genetically modified organisms, it's just using the DNA strand and snipping and making modifications within that. So I think that it has to withstand the rigor of scientific analysis and be tested and tried and made, and then if a majority of peer-reviewed scientists are in agreement with it, I think it could be a huge benefit to alleviating or making more efficient production of cattle and other ruminants. So, yeah, as long as it's done carefully and cautiously, I think it's okay.
I think taking a step before that, there's things that we can do before we get to this sort of gene editing phase. There was a report recently from a farm in the Loon Valley, where I'm from, actually, that was trialing a feed additive, an attempt to go carbon neutral, not my term. The cows were fed pellets of 10 milligrams a day containing garlic and citrus extracts to inhibit the methane-producing bacteria, which resulted in 30% reduction in emissions. I think that is probably something that's going to happen before we get to the CRISPR stage of things. I only know about that from the human medicine perspective, but it does seem to be very promising.
Yeah, we've been trying food additives for dairy cattle and beef cattle for about 40 years, and there's two or three challenges. One is that everybody wants to commercialise a particular mix of stuff, whether it's the Australian seaweed or the garlic or some fairly sort of intense chemicals that are also being added. And what people are looking for is a global market in that product, that commodity. So we're trying to solve a social problem, as usual, through somebody will come to market with a product they can make a lot of money on. And that feels a little bit frustrating when we have a climate emergency. So we do need to work out what works in terms of methane inhibitors, in terms of feed additives. But then once we've got those, we need to find ways, if they work, to support farmers to use them, but also to reliably differentiate that product, because at the moment methane's an externality. It doesn't harm me on my farm if my cow belch methane, right? So why would I spend £10 a day per cow to reduce that, or £5 or 50p? It doesn't benefit my business. So we have to find a way of changing the economics of that to make that work. But I think, going back to your other point, I'd agree with David. You know, CRISPR's still in the regulatory framework for the EU, and there's lots of people say CRISPR's got the advantage, it allows SMEs to get into the gene editing business and the problem. There is a danger of unintended consequences, that we put organisms out in the environment that have unforeseen effects, like the animals and plants we've moved around the world that end up destroying the native populations. And, you know, we don't want to be alarmist about this, but the precautionary principle means you have to work out what works. But I do think the danger has been that we've invested, as I say, because the market returns are in certain areas of research, we've invested a lot in that sort of research, whereas, for example, breeding better grasses for Scotland, we've spent absolutely no money on at all, right? Because even though most of what we grow is grass, you know, we haven't really paid our attention to growing resilient varieties that are nitrate, you know, resource use efficient in Scotland, that lock up carbon. Those aren't the characteristics we've been looking for in our breeding programs. So I think plant breeding, as always, and livestock breeding has got a big role to play in improving efficiency, but we need to breed for new characteristics now.
Have we got any more questions?
I was just wondering what your opinion was on veganism and how that helps the environment, because it's quite a trend at the moment. So I was just wondering what you guys thought about it.
Laura?
Yeah. I think a lot of people are just taking a drastic step, and I think it is a really important one, because if we look at statistics, even just in Scotland, if we're looking at emissions, obviously meat and dairy are extremely high, and if you're wanting to make a radical change for the environment, I think that is a very productive step you can do. Obviously, as we were discussing at the very beginning, it's about, if you're switching to plant-based, what are you switching it to? So thinking about, are you switching with lots of things like avocados and quinoa and lots of exotic fruit and veg that's definitely not coming from here? What's the impact to that? And I think as well, it's not just impacts based on emissions, it's also what land was that grown on? Is there a loss of biodiversity? Is it, how are the people treated that are making that food? And I think that in Scotland we have really high welfare standards, and we know where our food's from most of the time, and there's a lot more accountability. But if you're switching, kind of what are you switching to? And as well, a lot of vegan alternatives are made from things like soy-based. So it's about knowing what is in your alternatives. But I think it is a good step, and I think overall for people to reduce emissions on a personal level and as a whole, I think we need to be reducing the amount we rely on these meat and dairy. But it's not to say that cutting it out is the answer for everyone, because as we've also spoke about, there is land in Scotland that is no use for anything else. So if we were suddenly to stop doing animal agriculture, we might not be able to actually produce anything on there anyway, so then we'd be looking at exports, or we'd be looking at intensifying agriculture on the parts of land that we do have. So I think it's, yes, it is valid for a climatarian diet, but it's not meaning it's the only solution.
I think we have another question at the back.
So this is just a very practical, logistical question. If I wanted to inspire my community to get a milk round, how would I go about that?
Wow. Where do you stay?
Livingston.
Livingston?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, brilliant.
Yeah. There might already be a milk in glass bottle delivery there. You can postcode check on a lot of dairies' websites. A lot of the time it's just showing your community that it can be the same price, or if they're coming round, you know, they can do your whole street in one go, which is amazing. And it's really just talking about the practicalities of it and just trying to show people that it's making a huge difference. And as a community, you'd be reducing a lot of waste that you were producing. But there must be, I'm sure that, I don't know Livingston well, but there must be a dairy nearby. But this is one of the things I was doing. So the TED talk that I did was all about waste and plastic, and at the end I did a big visual, and it was, I brought on an average family of four's yearly consumption of milk in plastic bottles, and it was ridiculous, and it absolutely drowned me on the stage. But it really shocked people to see that's one family's worth of milk, and it's a great photo for showing people, actually, if that's you guys plus however many other people you can manage to do it, it's also a really great benefit for your recycling. So, but I think definitely just getting people interested and finding there will be one. I'm sure it will only take a wee Google to find out.
Do you have any idea what's profitable for a dairy, how many people they need? Because people often respond to a target. So if you say we need 100 people in this community to sign up, people often go for that. But do you have any sense of the...
So when I moved to Edinburgh, I phoned up a local dairy and asked them, and they said, it's worth our while giving you three deliveries a week, and that's just our flat. And obviously then I let people know that I was getting it, and it would make it worth their while. But I think it would be amazing for a dairy to find out there was a whole area wanting to do it. And you might be surprised, there might be people doing it already, but I don't know if there would be a threshold. That would probably be a question for the dairy.
Yeah, and I agree. I think, you know, the farmers who are putting the milk in glass bottles want to sell their milk. And, you know, if it's you and a couple of friends to start with, you know, you're probably better to start off with a few people so that the distribution isn't a real nightmare, and then grow it a bit organically. But I think you might get to a point where if you went back to there and said, look, we've got 50 people, you know, can you deliver more often, or can you give us better price, or whatever it is, then you might get that response. But we do need, as David was saying earlier, we need to see food as more of a relationship and less of a commodity. And the question is how we can find local distribution systems that actually are sustainable over time. Because if you just have one or two really keen people to make it work, and it just becomes difficult, a burden, people drop out, and you're left carrying it, that can be very dispiriting. So I think we haven't yet got to the point where we've got lots of examples of community-based cooperatives and distribution systems, but I think that's a huge part of the way forward. And this global trend of trying to disintermediate, you know, to take people out in the supply chains is part of this. The more we can support farmers to get more of the price of their commodity nearer to us, then the better. That is part of the change we need to see, certainly. And we were just talking to some organic farmers today where their milk price has dropped significantly, but they're still, what they're being paid is 26 pence a litre. And you think, even if you add quite a bit onto that, we could get it at a reasonable price. So,
I think we're going to have to wrap up, but before we do, I'd like to ask the panel, if you could leave the audience with one action that you'd like them to take, what would it be?
I'd like to tell everyone to be open-minded but skeptical at the same time. So I think that sounds like an oxymoron, but you've got to go out there and try to find big truth, I think, every day yourself, which puts the responsibility on everybody. But the more you do that, I think it kind of, you make these incremental gains, and then you kind of get to this point where you're making a lot of progress. Well, at first, that learning curve can be steep. So I think that sounds a bit abstract, but If you just kind of keep the big picture and be open-minded, but then you get in there and you try to really, you're open to any kind of idea, but then you look at it and scrutinize it very closely and keep updating your information based on keep updating your opinion based on new information.
I would say exactly that. But then when you get overwhelmed because you suddenly are reading lots, if you just think, nope, too much, I can't read anymore, the best thing to do is just think, what is the closest to me? Who can I support locally? And can I get it package free? And I'm just not going to waste it.
I absolutely agree. Yeah. Buy one less industrial chicken and a little bit of organic beef or lamb, I would say, and find a farm near you that you can support.
Laura Young, David Nazeri, Pete Ritchie, thank you very, very much. And there's an awful lot to think about there. And thank you, too, to the audience for joining us here today. We have two more podcasts to be recorded. At 2 p.m., we are looking at women in agriculture. And tomorrow, we are going to be looking at the rise of the machines and the use of technology in farming. So give yourselves a big round of applause and thank you for joining us today.